queen of the movement. I publicly stated numerous times that I was not a member of the alt-right, but it didn't make any difference. Nothing would make the media tell the truth. Journalists simply lie and lie until their enemies are beaten into submission. The only people who want me at the head of the alt-right are the mainstream media, who have variously labelled me as a leader, a self-proclaimed leader, and a face of the movement. These include NPR, the BBC, Bloomberg, Daily Beast, Daily Telegraph, Prospect, Evening Standard, The New Republic, and many, many more. On the one hand, these guys are declaring the alt-right to be a racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic hate group. On the other, they're saying that a gay Jew with a black boyfriend is at the head of it. Something here doesn't quite add up, but of course consistency has never been a strong point of the American media. I'm willing to accept that there are a few idiots working at NPR and the Daily Beast who simply don't know better, but the rest are just outright liars. No matter how visually appealing my face is, the alt-right does not want me associated with them. Perhaps some of the younger, less serious memesters wouldn't mind, but the hardline white supremacists are unequivocal about it. How do I know? Well, they tell us. I am hereby declaring a holy crusade against Milo Yiannopoulos, who is the single greatest threat our movement has at this time. Those are the words of Daily Stormer editor Andrew Anglin last year. Anglin added, "He is our arch nemesis. We need to stop this kike." Frankly, I'm overjoyed that both infantile communists and internet Nazis all hate my guts. All the worst people in the world, feminists, cyclists, Black Lives Matter activists, vapors, vegans, and yes, the couple thousand Bitcoin brown shirts living in their parents' basements who still call themselves alt-right, all really hate me. But to the idiots at NBC News, USA Today, and CNN, the editor of the most hardcore alt-right site on the web declared me the movement's arch nemesis. If any of these failing outlets are prepared to actually report that fact, I'll send the reporter $10,000 myself. Breitbart's former executive chairman Steve Bannon offered a nuanced take on the alt-right to the Wall Street Journal, defining it as, quote, "younger people who are anti-globalism, very nationalist, and terribly anti-establishment," end quote. Unfortunately, nuance doesn't play well in the mainstream media, so Breitbart was repeatedly pigeonholed by the press as an alt-right platform. Yes, as an alt-right platform. That's Breitbart, where virtually the entire management team and most senior editors are Jewish, the same Breitbart that publishes the Breitbart Jerusalem vertical. This Breitbart is supposedly a platform for a movement, according to the mainstream media, that hates Jews in Israel. The media's ultimate target was the incoming Trump administration, which is why they stepped up their attacks on Breitbart after Steve Bannon was appointed to the campaign team. The Huffington Post and The Intercept both published mind-bending explainers on how it could be that Bannon was somehow both anti-Semitic and pro-Israel at the same time. According to The Independent, Bannon was an alt-right media baron with the ear of the president. According to The LA Times, the alt-right was actually Steve Bannon's fringe brand of conservatism. Once again, the fake news media displayed its talent for spinning a web of lies across multiple publications. But this was 2016, a year that, unlike any other, proved just how absurd, powerless, and morally bankrupt the press had become. Donald Trump ignored the media pressure, and he named Steve Bannon his chief strategist. Today, the alt-right is dead. It was killed by the media. You see, if you call something neo-Nazi for long enough, it will invariably, inevitably, ultimately, attract actual neo-Nazis, and this may surprise you, scare off normal people. The alt-right has always had a fringe element of Reich-loving basement dwellers who describe the Holocaust as a hollow hoax and want to ban race mixing. But when Alan Bakari and I wrote our alt-right guide, these were just one of the many factions in the alt-right, alongside dissident intellectuals, taboo-breaking teens, and instinctive social conservatives. An Israel-supporting former Tea Party member was, in those days, just as likely to be drawn to the alt-right as a Richard Spencer devotee, because it was the most exciting, dynamic, and effective right-wing movement to emerge since the Tea Party. Even leftist outlets like BuzzFeed acknowledged its power to dominate the internet and influence the news cycle. One week in September, shortly after Hillary Clinton read out several of my headlines in a speech about the alt-right, the national broadcast media spoke of little besides Pepe the Frog. Pepe, for the uninitiated, is a cartoon frog from a webcomic that went viral in the mid-noughties. Originally used as a reaction image to signify a poster's emotional response to something, there are sad Pepes, happy Pepes, angry Pepes, and smug Pepes, the frog inexplicably evolved into something of a mascot for the alt-right and for Trump supporters. Following the classic media playbook of, if you don't understand it, call it racist, the media branded this innocent cartoon frog a symbol of white supremacy. We should give thanks to NPR, CNN, and the Southern Poverty Law Center for identifying the real causes of racial tension in America. It isn't terrible schools, or black fatherlessness, or even constant race baiting from hucksters like Al Sharpton. No, it's a cartoon frog. If you're wondering why largely apolitical trolls are attracted to the alt-right, this is it, because nothing tickles us more than getting the entire world to discuss one of our memes and desperately try to make sense of it. Double points if it makes people angry and they start calling it names on cable news. Thanks to the willingness of old-school conservatives to march in lockstep with the mainstream media, the alt-right gradually came to be dominated not by friends of Pepe, but by actual white nationalists. A turning point came shortly after Donald Trump's election victory, when Richard Spencer encouraged a room full of his supporters to hail Trump, which about three people promptly did with what we call Roman salutes. Even nominal white identitarians like Paul Ramsey decided they'd had enough with the movement after that and disavowed it. It increasingly looks like the only people left in the alt-right movement are the Holocaust deniers, Richard Spencer fans, and Daily Stormer readers. And if that's the case, I want nothing to do with it. As I've made clear, the movement wants nothing to do with me, but I can guarantee you CNN will continue to refer to me as the alt-right's leader anyway. The tragedy of the alt-right is that it had some legitimate grievances. Demographic transformation, popular anti-white rhetoric, affirmative action, identity politics for some and not for others, enforced diversity. These are just a few of them, but the alt-right won't continue to receive attention for these things. It will continue to be painted as another word for Nazi. Pepe, I'm happy to report, has escaped the redefinition of alt-right mostly unscathed, and still exists as a mascot on American college campuses, where he is used as a symbol of dissidence and resistance to progressive left orthodoxy. If leftists continue to ignore sensible moderates like me, the frustrations that animate alt-righters are only going to grow stronger. There is no rampant anti-Semitism in America today, except from Muslims, and there is no widespread white nationalist movement. But one day there might be, if the media keeps calling people like me white supremacists, all because they can't work out how to beat a gay version of Anna Nicole Smith in an argument about campus rape culture. Chapter 3. Why Twitter Hates Me. In May 2016, Facebook was embroiled in that year's second biggest tech controversy. The first was my own suspension from Twitter, but more about that in a minute. Facebook had been caught in a lie. Its trending news feature, ostensibly designed to provide users with a list of the most popular topics being discussed on the platform that day, was being manipulated. Despite heralding a new age of free, unfiltered information in its early days, the differences between new media and old media turned out not to be that great. Both were spoon-feeding information to their readers, deciding for the public what they should and shouldn't see. But it wasn't supposed to be this way. In the early years of Facebook, the idea of an editor deciding what information you most needed to see was laughable. Equally, there was no algorithm deciding who saw what posts when and where. The system was simple. Users followed other users and saw a list of those users' posts, updated in real time, in order. Beyond the block button, there was no filtering. If your friend made a post at 6:15, you saw it at 6:15. The present system, where Facebook chooses what you see, when you see it, and how you see it, is a radical departure from its early ideals. Facebook says their trending list is meant to highlight major events and meaningful conversations. Well, these are sort of politically neutral metrics, but it's not hard to predict what will happen when a company in one of the most progressive industries, tech, located in the most progressive city in America, San Francisco, trusts its staff to implement policies neutrally. And so, inevitably, in May 2016, it was revealed that Facebook was discriminating against topics of interest to conservatives on its trending news feature. A former employee of the team told Gizmodo that, in addition to neglecting conservative trends, the company also suppressed stories about itself and artificially promoted stories about the Black Lives Matter movement. According to Gizmodo, Facebook's team of news curators were, quote, told to select articles from a list of preferred media outlets that included sites like The New York Times, Time, Variety, and other liberal mainstream outlets. They would regularly avoid sites like World Star Hip Hop, The Blaze, and Breitbart, but were never explicitly told to suppress those outlets, end quote. A leaked document published in The Guardian later confirmed that Facebook would check against a list of preferred mainstream outlets, including the BBC, The New York Times, CNN, and Fox, before assigning a story national-level importance. In other words, it was up to places like CNN to sign off on stories from right-leaning outlets. Anyone spot the problem? Facebook's policy of discrimination against conservatives wasn't mandated from the top down, but it didn't need to be. Silicon Valley companies don't have to institute policies of bias against conservatives. All they have to do is give minimal oversight to their overwhelmingly left-leaning employees and turn a blind eye to the inevitable consequences. And that is, of course, what Facebook did. A former employee told Gizmodo, quote, "We choose what's trending. There was no real standard for measuring what qualified as news and what didn't. It was up to the news curator to decide," end quote. This source told Gizmodo exactly what this meant for conservative news and for progressive news too. In short, the former was suppressed or deep-sixed, according to internal Facebook jargon, while the latter was promoted. Again, from Gizmodo, quote, "Among the deep-sixed or suppressed topics on the list were former IRS official Lois Lerner, who was accused by Republicans of inappropriately scrutinizing conservative groups, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, popular conservative news aggregator The Drudge Report, Chris Kyle, the former Navy SEAL who was murdered in 2013, and former Fox News contributor Stephen Crowder," end quote. Meanwhile, according to the source, Facebook's left-leaning staff pressured Mark Zuckerberg to use Facebook to help swing the election for Hillary Clinton and blamed him for not doing enough after she lost. As for Black Lives Matter, Facebook got a lot of pressure about not having a trending topic for Black Lives Matter, the source said. Quote, "When we injected it, everyone started saying, yeah, now I'm seeing it as number one," end quote. This particular injection is especially noteworthy because the Black Lives Matter movement originated on Facebook, and the ensuing media coverage of the movement often noted its powerful social media presence. Facebook's political bias scandal took place after Twitter's, but unlike Twitter, Facebook actually matters to normal people, so it caused an instant response from politicians. A petition was created by the Republican National Committee stating Facebook must answer for conservative censorship. Senator John Thune, then chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, also called on Facebook to explain itself. He said, "If Facebook presents its trending topics section as the result of a neutral, objective algorithm, but is in fact subjective, Facebook's assertion that it maintains a platform for people and perspectives from across the political spectrum misleads the public." Shocked by the response, Facebook leapt into action. They announced a whitewashing internal report, which of course found no wrongdoing at the company, and invited a bunch of establishment conservatives to a closed-door meeting at their Menlo Park headquarters. Breitbart received an invitation to attend the meeting, but unlike SE Cup, Glenn Beck, and other assorted establishment types, we declined to attend. The invitation was clearly only a photo op and not a serious effort to engage with conservatives, so we didn't go. Instead, I asked Mark Zuckerberg to answer in a live debate with me to the only group who mattered, the millions of conservatives who used his platform. He refused. I'm a humble man, and I can handle not receiving attention. So my response to Facebook's snub was characteristically gracious and mild. Along with my colleague, Alan Bukhari, I wrote a series of stories exposing the wacky progressive views of Facebook's trending news team, leading to them all getting fired. They were all replaced with computer algorithms. America, you are welcome. Political activist Pamela Geller, who was banned from Facebook following the Muslim terror attack in Orlando, is also not letting the matter of Facebook's bias stand. Geller is currently suing the company, and in an article for Breitbart, she explained why. Quote, "I am sick and tired of the suppression of our speech. We are unable to engage in the public square. And yes, Facebook is the public square. It's where we connect. We have to fight for it. Shouting into the wilderness is not freedom of speech. My Facebook page has close to 300,000 followers, and combined with my pages, SIOA, SION, AFDI, the reach is another 100,000. It's a critical connection. Facebook has immense power over organic media, the sharing of our information and news between friends and our associates. I would say too much power. They're trying to change the people by restricting our access to information." End quote. Gun shop owners, immigration hawks, and admins of right-wing meme pages have all also faced censorship from Facebook. Sadly, out of the leading web companies, Facebook is perhaps the best of the bunch. The impression I get from speaking to Facebook's management behind closed doors is of a company trying desperately to rein in its own hyper-progressive employees. A report from the Wall Street Journal revealed that in the middle of the 2016 campaign, Mark Zuckerberg faced pressure from his community standards team to censor content from Donald Trump, whom they argued was engaging in hate speech. The team even threatened to quit if Trump wasn't censored, but Zuckerberg reportedly held his ground. The CEO also stood fast when faced with pressure to remove Trump supporter Peter Thiel from Facebook's board, releasing a statement in support of political diversity. The company said, quote, "We care deeply about diversity. That's easy to say when it means standing up for ideas you agree with. It's a lot harder when it means standing up for the rights of people with different viewpoints to say what they care about," end quote. Now, this doesn't make Zuckerberg special, assuming this isn't a deception, because remember, he once called his own users dumb fucks for trusting him with their personal data. He's doing the bare minimum of what we would expect from social media companies, which is providing people with a platform to air their opinions without letting his personal politics get in the way. Facebook requires constant policing from the conservative media to keep the biases of its staff in check. On numerous occasions, wrongfully suspended accounts like Pamela Geller's have only been reinstated following coverage from Breitbart. Facebook only took concerns over its trending news team seriously after conservative media got involved, and only fired them after Breitbart reported on their political biases. And so we turn to Twitter. That trunk of humours, that bolting hutch of beastliness, that swollen parcel of dropsies, that huge bombard of sack, that stuffed cloak bag of guts, that roasted Manning Tree ox with pudding in his belly, that reverend vice, that grey iniquity, that father ruffian, that vanity in years. My love of Shakespeare has provided me with so many colourful ways to describe Twitter and its sandal-wearing hobo-chic CEO, Jack Dorsey. Twitter stock has declined some 80% since 2014, and user growth has stalled since 2013. Karma and divine retribution are alive and well. Once the most attention-grabbing of the social media platforms, Twitter promised to usher in a new age of instant democratic free expression. Its character limit encouraged users to share rapid-fire thoughts with the world without a filter. And in its early days, Twitter could justifiably claim it showed us what was on the world's mind at any given moment. And it was fun. It was fun to watch governments and politicians humbled in the face of the global citizenry's unmodified opinions. It was fun to engage in raucous back and forth between liberals, conservatives, and libertarians on a platform which, for a while at least, was the opposite of a safe space. It could embarrass governments, kill officially mandated myths, and even topple dictators. It was dangerous. So naturally, I was a fan. My Twitter handle was @Nero, a nod to the Roman emperor known for his good looks, his artistic spirit, and for lighting his enemies on fire. Twitter was about freedom, fun, and the humbling of authority, so it was only a matter of time before progressive crybabies ruined it for everyone. In late 2015, co-founder Jack Dorsey replaced relatively pro-free speech Dick Costolo as permanent CEO. Dorsey, a very close friend of DeRay Mackeson, has marched with Black Lives Matter in Ferguson, Missouri, and he quickly set about turning Twitter into a Sharia-compliant, conservative-free zone. Like any CEO, Dorsey can't admit his political bias openly. On the rare occasions when he does address the issue, he insists that the platform is politically neutral. In an interview with the Today Show's Matt Lauer, Dorsey flatly denied that Twitter censors anything other than threats of violence, insisting Twitter merely exists to empower conversation. Yet, 2 months after Dorsey became CEO, actor Adam Baldwin received a temporary suspension for a tweet implying that conservatives and libertarians were more sexually attractive than left-wingers, an observation that has been repeatedly confirmed by surveys and studies. The tweet broke none of Twitter's rules, yet Baldwin was forced to delete it before his account was restored. This was at the same time angry death threats to Donald Trump were an unchecked daily occurrence. I knew it was only a matter of time before Dorsey came for me. In October 2015, Fusion referred to me as the internet's biggest troll. They said I had terrifying allure. Well, they weren't wrong. A few months later, Twitter removed my blue verified checkmark. Not for any specific reason, you understand. They just saw how popular I was becoming and wanted to squash me. For this brave act, the Huffington Post congratulated the platform for standing up for women online. Give me a break. Verified checks are given out to prominent figures likely to be impersonated, and I'm probably the most impersonated person on the internet who isn't Beyonce, but Twitter still took away my checkmark for ideological reasons, and at the time, this was unprecedented. I knew from that moment that Twitter was looking for any excuse to ban me, and they would eventually, of course, find one. I also knew that when they succeeded, all hell would break loose. I wasn't disappointed, although Twitter's shareholders probably are now. The pretext needed to ban me turned out to be the all-female reboot of Ghostbusters, a remarkably bad film that flopped at the box office and contributed to Sony's decision to take a near billion-dollar write-down on its movie business. I published a catty review of this abominable movie, tarring it with my trademark reserve, as a crime against comedy. It is perhaps the only movie I have ever seen conceived entirely out of spite, I said, which would have been okay if it were remotely funny. I castigated the abysmal performances from the lead actresses, including the inexplicably popular Leslie Jones. The film had been attracting controversy, of course, for months before its release. When its trailer debuted on YouTube, it was immediately assailed upon by peeved pop culture fans of the classic Bill Murray movie. They had read reports about director Paul Feig's plans to reinvent the franchise from the ground up, as well as his seemingly sparse knowledge of the Ghostbusters universe. Feig had basically transformed a movie about four out-of-shape, middle-aged men, three of them white and one of them black, to a chick flick with four out-of-shape, middle-aged women, three of them white and one of them black. It was hardly groundbreaking stuff. This, coupled with the fact that the promo video was intensely boring, led it to become the most disliked movie trailer in YouTube history. Under normal circumstances, this would not be hugely controversial. Cult franchises like Ghostbusters can be treacherous territory. Upset the fans and you may be in for a lifetime of loathing. Just think what fans did to George Lucas after The Phantom Menace. But these weren't normal circumstances, and the fans' reaction to Ghostbusters quickly became a media and political controversy. Partly as a means to market the movie, Feig and the Ghostbusters cast began denouncing its critics as misogynist and right-wing. The media, depressingly but perhaps predictably, swallowed this obvious attempt to delegitimize criticism and ran with it. Not just the film media, of course, but also the political, mainstream, and even the alternative media. They all had the perfect story. Four helpless actresses were being preyed upon by hordes of anonymous men on the internet. The frantic pro-Ghostbusters campaign reached peak absurdity when, after disappointing box office returns, politicians from the California Legislative Women's Caucus gathered at a private screening to watch the movie. After the viewing, their leading members gave what felt to me like a series of prearranged statements to journalists, each one of them celebrating the movie as a work of high art and a progressive leap forward. As always, the smell of what we call butthurt attracts the trolls, and Breitbart editor Ezra Doulis put it eloquently. He said, quote, "To a Twitter troll, there is no greater rush than a response from an angry celebrity. The knowledge that you, in the middle of Podunkville, USA, have the power to get under the skin of someone rich, famous, and surrounded by ass kissers," end quote. So when Leslie Jones, one of the four leading actresses in this cinematic train wreck, began angrily responding to her detractors on Twitter, the result was inevitable. She was feeding the trolls, so they swarmed like frogs on a grasshopper. Media reports say I was the one who led these swarms, which couldn't be further from the truth. Jones was engaging in running battles with her detractors on Twitter for hours before I got involved, actively trading insults with them and provoking them. I criticized Jones, tossing a few jabs her way. The reason lefties in the media saw me as ringleader of the trolls is that it's quite hard for them to imagine people moving collectively without a leader. It's their authoritarianism showing, you see. For them, a herd must have a shepherd. The idea of people thinking and acting independently frightens leftists. My only crime was daring to criticize a black woman, which itself is seemingly proof of racism today. I tweeted that Jones was playing the victim, which she was, that her character in Ghostbusters was an unfunny racial stereotype, which it was, and that her tweets were barely literate, which they are. All these things are true, and despite calling people bitches all evening, Jones had the audacity to report me for that last one. Like Mogwai, there are very specific rules to follow when it comes to feeding trolls, or else you'll end up with gremlins. A small minority tweeted admittedly revolting things at Jones, such as comparisons between her and Harambe, the recently deceased gorilla. Jones accused me of supporting the racists tweeting her gorilla pictures, which was wrong, and she also retweeted sycophants accusing me of being a gay Uncle Tom. Later, she would laughably claim that the retweets were a result of her being hacked. Isn't that always the case? Finally, she blocked me and closed her Twitter account. I sent out one final tweet, which read, "Rejected by yet another black dude," and left it at that. Another easy victory over a hypocritical, thin-skinned Hollywood celebrity. Or so I thought. I can't stand celebrities with thin skin. Getting hate mail is part and parcel of being famous, no matter what you do or what you look like. Even somebody as ridiculously good-looking as me gets hate mail from time to time. But I wasn't prepared for what happened next. You see, the next day, a day that will live in social media infamy, I was scheduled to headline a Gays for Trump party at the Republican National Convention. A few minutes before I took the stage, I was banned from Twitter forever. I suspect, but can't prove, that they waited until just before my event deliberately to cause maximum damage. This, remember, is a company whose employees wrote #ScrewNero on a whiteboard in the San Francisco headquarters of Twitter. They didn't plan, of course, on my preternatural skill for turning every minor setback into a glittering and gigantic success. Like all progressive imbeciles, Twitter HQ was clueless about the Streisand effect. Whenever censorship is attempted, it simply draws more attention to the target. The immediate result of my ban was the greatest barrage of press attention I'd ever received, at least up until then. I became patient zero in Twitter's crusade against conservatives, particularly the Trump-supporting kind. CNN, CNBC, and ABC all wanted me on to talk about it. Sometimes I wonder if my biggest enemies are in fact my biggest friends and are all secretly helping me out while pretending to be leftists in public. I was the number one trending topic for a full day, with tens of thousands of users tweeting Free Milo in solidarity. My fans scrawled the slogan in chalk outside Twitter's international network of offices, and one of my more mischievous admirers filmed himself convincing a group of animal rights activists to chant Free Milo after persuading them that I was a captive donkey. Do I feel bad about being a catalyst for Twitter's censorship? No more than Jean-Luc Picard should feel bad about being a catalyst for the Borg's invasion of Federation space, because despite what you'll have read in the media, I neither tweeted anything racist or harassing at Leslie Jones, nor did I in any way encourage the few anonymous people who did. Twitter says I led targeted harassment against Jones, which seems to mean being famous and having the wrong opinions. Well, my supposed harassment was so bad, Jones was driven off Twitter, they say, but it can't have been that bad, because she was back after 48 hours. This is a shocking double standard. We don't blame Justin Bieber when he tweets or posts on Instagram about Selena Gomez, no matter what the death and rape threats that come to her afterwards. And we don't blame Beyonce for what the Beehive does to Taylor Swift. They're never held accountable for the actions of their fans by the media. If Bieber or Beyonce came out as Trump supporters, though, I guarantee you this would change. Remember the second most famous person to be banned from Twitter ever, Azealia Banks, now a friend of mine, a black female rapper with a long history of misbehavior on Twitter, who was banned 2 weeks after she, guess what, came out for Trump. Another thing you won't read in the press is that Leslie Jones directly incited harassment against her critics, the very rule violation I was falsely accused of when Twitter suspended my account. A user suggested to Jones that some introspection might be in order if she wanted to stop the wave of trolling, to which Jones responded with an unequivocal call to dogpile. She said, "Bitch, I want to tell everyone about you, but I'm going to let everybody else do it. I'm going to retweet your hate, !! Get her, !! In another tweet, she also urged her followers to go after them like they going after me. Twitter did nothing in the face of these flagrant rule violations. Jones didn't even have to delete her tweets to unlock her account, which, as I now know, is the site's mildest form of punishment for a terms of service breach. I don't mean to sound whiny about any of this, because my Twitter ban made me a lot more famous, and it was in fact one of the best things that ever happened to me. It broke my addiction to the constant little dopamine hits I got from all those retweets and likes. And these days, I get a lot more work done. Plus, being banned was cool, like Madonna and Andrew Dice Clay being banned from MTV in the 1990s. I joined an elite club of dangerous people banned from Twitter, like Azealia Banks and right-wing investigative journalist Chuck Johnson. As a result of my Twitter ban, of course, I became, for a huge slice of young America, a forbidden guilty pleasure. So yes, I don't mean to whine, and that's not my intention here, because I'm not in the least bit sad about it, but it is important to set the record straight when the lying mainstream media comes for you with its usual arsenal of name-calling, hysteria, selective disclosure, and downright mendacity. With me out of the way, the left has proceeded in its crusade to censor Twitter with a barrage of pressure from allies in politics and the media. A host of feminist windbags, including ghoulish Democratic Congresswoman Catherine Clark and hand-wringing British Labour MP Stella Creasy, have ginned up a panic about death threats and trolls, supposedly striking fear into innocent, powerless women on Twitter. Coincidentally, these women almost always turn out to be professional feminist activists and left-wing politicians. The narrative was repeated ad nauseam across national media in both Britain and America, and it has not stopped since. Slowly, the platform that once proclaimed itself the free speech wing of the Free Speech Party began to contort into a feminist-friendly safe space. Making a joke about feminists put you at risk of losing your account. But you could tweet "kill all white men," "masculinity so fragile," or "I bathe in male tears" without a care in the world. Countless right-wingers have been kicked off Twitter, sometimes temporarily and sometimes permanently, including cultural libertarian YouTuber Sargon of Akkad and the Canadian writer and anti-feminist Janet Bloomfield. They even put a safety filter on all outgoing links to the blog of Vox Dei, science fiction's leading right-wing iconoclast. Twitter came down hard on the alt-right. After the 2016 election, dozens of the movement's prominent voices got the boot. At the same time, Jerome Hudson, an African-American writer for Breitbart, was bombarded with racial slurs, including Coon and Uncle Tom, instigated by washed-up rapper Talib Kweli, and Twitter took no action whatsoever. In the 2 months following the election, social media analytics discovered more than 12,000 tweets calling for the death of Donald Trump, tweets that remain on the platform today. Yet Twitter continues to profess its political neutrality. In my time as technology editor for Breitbart, I never saw an account suspended for sending death or rape threats to Donald Trump or any other prominent conservative. Twitter was secretly discriminating against conservative news sources well before the words fake news emerged from a progressive news outlet. In February 2016, a source who worked closely with Twitter revealed to Breitbart that the company had been shadow banning inconvenient Twitter users and that it maintained a whitelist of trusted news sources. Shadow banning, if you don't know, is the secret practice of removing or minimizing a user's posts from public view without alerting that user, who often continues to post, believing that nothing has changed. Shortly after Trump's inauguration, Twitter acknowledged that they were hiding tweets from search results. They began marking entire accounts as sensitive content, forcing users to opt in to see certain tweets rather than opting out to remove unwanted information. The Drudge Report, perhaps the biggest conservative site on the internet, was flagged as sensitive content by Twitter. If Dorsey won't address his platform's blatant bias, he might one day have to answer to the courts. On March 4th, 2016, I asked President Obama's press secretary, Josh Earnest, during a White House press briefing, what role Obama might play in reminding social media platforms about the importance of protecting free expression. Earnest made it clear that even Obama believed that the success of social media platforms is, quote, predicated on the important protection of First Amendment rights to self-expression, end quote. He also recommended that Twitter users who feel aggrieved by the platform's policies turn to lawsuits as a response. Several such lawsuits are already in the works, and that was under President Obama, the most powerful progressive of the last two decades. If Twitter's censorious direction receives stern words from his administration, Dorsey ought to be quivering in his Birkenstocks with Daddy in office. The death of Twitter is, at this point, inevitable, but Jack Dorsey certainly isn't doing anything to slow down the process. You see, censorship creates a chilling effect, frightening other users from speaking their minds. On Twitter, a site designed for rapid-fire streams of consciousness, that means nothing short of the total death of the platform. There's an impression put about by the media and abetted by Twitter itself, now stupidly accepted by just about everyone, that Twitter's problems, and the reason the company hasn't been acquired, boil down to abuse and harassment. Actually, the opposite is true. The history of social networks knows no exception to this simple rule. When you start clamping down on free expression, you die. Twitter is no different. It cannot maintain user growth because it's boring. All the cool people have either left, been banned, or they now just watch their speech so carefully, terrified of falling afoul of Twitter's rules or getting banned, that the product is terrible. The problem isn't trolls. If trolls were the problem, comment sections, Reddit, 4chan, and YouTube would have closed down years ago. You see, the thing is, people love getting into spats on the internet. Some people spend their whole lives doing it. The only people who object to ridicule and criticism are touchy, fragile celebrities and journalists with brittle egos who can't cope with readers pointing out how biased and stupid they are. Twitter's problem isn't that there's too much edgy speech, it's that there's too little. Also, Twitter's product is so badly engineered that people who don't really want to hear from each other too often do. And I can't believe I'm the only person who understands this, but the media's war on trolls is just another kind of class warfare. Politically correct, university-educated elites don't like how the working classes speak. They're horrified by the ribald humour, sharp language and raucous tone of blue-collar interactions. So they brand it all abuse and harassment, and they close their comment sections because they're too delicate to engage with ordinary people. The edgiest and most interesting people have now either left Twitter or they've been struck off. So the platform's dying, and so is the business behind it. And it makes me feel sort of bad for anyone banned after 2016 as kind of behind the curve. And as for suspending me because of a spat with Leslie Jones, I mean, if you're going to sell out your core values to a celebrity, you could at least pick someone funny, talented, or hot. Twitter might be the Silicon Valley company where progressive bias is most apparent, but Google is the company at which it's most dangerous. If Google decides that it doesn't want web users to find something, it would be very difficult for us to stop them, or even to find out that they'd done anything in the first place. That's probably why, out of all the Silicon Valley companies accused of bias, it was Google that Donald Trump addressed directly. The occasion that led him to address it was the release of an explosive video showing bias in Google's search results. In the video, tech channel SourceFed demonstrated that searches for Hillary Clinton did not autocomplete to words that were popular searches if they reflected negatively on the Democratic candidate. For instance, Hillary Clinton CRI did not autocomplete to the popular search term Hillary Clinton criminal. This contrasted with the competing, though far less influential, Bing and Yahoo search engines, where all search terms autocomplete correctly. Google denied altering its search results to favor Clinton, saying it does not autocomplete terms that are offensive or disparaging when displayed in conjunction with a person's name. But this wasn't true. A later experiment from prominent psychologist Robert Epstein found that it's easy to get Google to display negative search terms for Clinton's primary opponent, Bernie Sanders, and, of course, for Donald Trump. Eric Schmidt, CEO of the company that owns Google, is very much in the mold of Tim Cook, Jack Dorsey, and Mark Zuckerberg. But unlike those three, his involvement in politics suggests a direct link between his work and support for left-wing politicians. Schmidt, you see, founded The Groundwork, a campaign organization with the sole purpose of putting Hillary Clinton in the White House by putting Silicon Valley's technological prowess at the campaign's disposal. WikiLeaks has confirmed Schmidt's involvement with the Clinton campaign in an email leak, which included a Democratic staffer acknowledging that Schmidt's group was working directly and indirectly with the Clinton team. A leaked email sent from Schmidt himself suggested the creation of a voter database that regularly aggregates all that is known about individual voters. Creating such a database is Orwellian in the extreme and sounds daunting, but if there is one company that could do it, it is, of course, Google. And it's not just for Hillary Clinton. A report from The Intercept in April 2016 revealed just how close Google's relationship with the Obama administration had been. The report showed that Google representatives attended meetings in the White House more than once a week on average from the beginning of Obama's presidency until October 2015. The Intercept's report also showed how Google operated a revolving door with the White House, with employees frequently moving between both. They noted 55 instances of employees leaving Google for federal government jobs during the Obama years. 29 of them went to work directly in the White House, and 127 government employees left their jobs to work at Google. With such a close relationship, it's little wonder Eric Schmidt fought so hard to elect Hillary Clinton, the Obama continuity candidate. One of Robert Epstein's earlier experiments found that manipulation of search results can convince undecided voters to back a candidate with frightening efficiency. In some demographics, Epstein found that the conversion rate was up to 80%. If conservatives thought that mainstream media was bad, just wait until you see the effects of search engine bias. Some might consider conservatives fortunate that tech companies didn't use all the powers at their disposal to influence the election. After all, Google could, if they wanted, ban all links to Breitbart, as could Twitter and Facebook. Ultimately, such a bold move would be a bad business decision. In the current climate, conservatives feel just safe enough on social media not to flock to competing platforms. There is growing awareness that the companies that serve as conduits for speech on the web are no longer politically neutral, but maybe there's not quite enough yet to trigger a mass exodus. Given the high-tech forces ranged against him, it's nothing short of a miracle that Donald Trump won the presidency. In 2020, when social media and search engines are likely to wield even more power, he may not be so lucky. If conservatives want to keep winning, they need to get serious about Silicon Valley, and it needs to happen fast. Aside from rare exceptions like Peter Thiel, almost everyone in the world of tech absolutely hates Republicans. Jack Dorsey is in bed cuddling with Black Lives Matter. He's brought censorious feminists into Twitter to advise the company on who it should ban from the platform. Mark Zuckerberg, meanwhile, is an ardent globalist who believes the United States should follow Germany's lead on immigration. Eric Schmidt might be less vocal, but as we know, he's potentially far more dangerous. He already worked to put Hillary Clinton in the White House, and who knows what he learned from her loss, or what he will do to sabotage Trump over the course of this presidency. The biggest advantage conservatives have on the web is the Drudge Report, an incredibly well-trafficked news aggregator run by conservative media pioneer Matt Drudge. The site can instantly make a story go viral and has been a constant thorn in the side of progressives seeking dominance of the web. But it's not a social platform. Social media continues to advance, and we cannot allow progressives to monopolize it without a fight. Social media bias is far more dangerous to conservatives than mainstream media bias. Users believe they're choosing information sources themselves and are more trusting as a result. So if conservatives, including President Trump, want to avoid disaster, they need to get serious about pressuring Silicon Valley to stay honest. They should raise the specter of antitrust, of media regulation, and all the other regulatory demons feared by America's social media companies, who have many legal and financial reasons for wanting to remain classified by the courts as politically neutral platforms, even though everyone knows they're not. Republicans need to get aggressive. They need to constantly scrutinize and investigate social media companies, keeping them under the spotlight at all times. They must keep their feet to the fire. They need to organize around and encourage competitors. It may be difficult for 60-year-old politicians who still need their grandkids to unlock their phones for them, but it is their own political future at stake. So grandpa, hire an intern. And as for ordinary users, we need to fight back against companies that now oversee so much of our day-to-day communications. Learn the data laws of your home country, what information social media companies are allowed to keep on your activities, and what they're required to hand over if asked. Find other people who have been treated unjustly by social media companies and form pressure groups. Organize letter-writing campaigns to your local congressman or representative. Tell conservative and libertarian journalists what's going on, and better yet, start your own business and create a platform that will live up to the original hopes for social media. Fighting back against politically biased social media companies is the most important battle for conservatives and libertarians in the coming decade. Leftists at a college campus might influence a few hundred other students if they're lucky. A social media company can influence tens of millions. There is no greater danger to free speech and free expression today than the far-left biases of Silicon Valley. We cannot let them get away with it. In the end, censors always lose, but they only lose when there are enough brave free speech warriors calling for their heads. Chapter 4. Why Feminists Hate Me. Feminism is dying. Although it has enormous influence on politically correct elites in the media and in Hollywood, support for it has collapsed among ordinary people of all political persuasions, thanks, at least in part, to hysterical feminist activists who peddle lies and conspiracy theories on a daily basis. Now, because I'm a compassionate soul, I'm going to explain in this chapter not only why feminists hate me, but also how they can turn things around for themselves. I'm not just doing this because I'm kind. I actually quite like giving my enemies a guide on how to beat me. That's how confident I am that I'm right. You see, it doesn't hurt when I explain the real world to feminists. It drives them even crazier than they already are. I like to call it Milo-splaining. The fight for women's rights, you see, started in the late 19th century and focused almost completely on women's suffrage. And this was back in the good old days. Now look, although these brave women were hideously ugly, they were pioneers and even heroes. And this is generally what's known as the first wave of feminism. The second wave, starting in the middle of the 20th century, was a broader sort of movement, but also grounded in laudable goals. Ending sexual harassment in the workplace, ending discrimination, repealing archaic laws enabling marital rape, and above all, establishing full equality of opportunity for women. Now, few reasonable people could disagree with these objectives. Still today, fair-minded women like Christina Hoff Sommers continue to beat the drum for what they call freedom feminism, a feminism that promises equal legal rights and equality of opportunity. Sadly for all of us, that isn't where the story of feminism ends. You see, third-wave feminism reared its fishy head in the 1990s, and the feminism Summer speaks of is almost unrecognizable in its messaging. To understand what it is third-wave feminists want, look at what they spend their time on. First, manspreading. This is a term used to describe the practice of spreading your legs apart on public transport. This alleged sexist outrage, which grew out of a feminist Tumblr, was made illegal in the city of New York. Consider mansplaining, the grievous sin of explaining something to a woman whilst being male. Man-threading is doing the same on social media. These aren't illegal just yet. Eggplant emojis have drawn the attention of third-wave feminists. According to one blogger, they're the next frontier in online harassment. Eggplants, you see, look similar to purple penises. And in a sign of just how eager mainstream society is to please feminists, Instagram banned the eggplant emoji. I have since switched to using the Eiffel Tower emoji when my boyfriend asks me what I want for dinner, but please, nobody tell Jezebel. Air conditioning is also sexist. Men apparently can deal with the cold better, so they sort of obstinately keep the air conditioning right the way up in office buildings, making women uncomfortable and forcing them to drape themselves with blankets. I get quite cold easily too, but I've never considered turning it into a socio-political issue. How did all these things come to be nationally politicized at a time when fewer than one in five American women describes herself as a feminist? How and why did corporations start taking complaints from New York bloggers seriously when their actual customers so clearly don't give a shit? As the political moderate columnist Heather Wilhelm puts it, I didn't leave feminism, it left me. Wilhelm's sentiment is shared by increasing swathes of the Western public, male and female, liberal and conservative. Feminism describes itself merely as a movement for female equality, but it behaves like something quite different. It behaves like a vindictive, spiteful, mean-spirited festival of man-hating. In Britain, only 7% of people choose to label themselves as feminist. In America, the number is higher, but only 18%, according to a Vox poll. Vox being that well-known conservative outlet. Another poll from YouGov and the Huffington Post found that 23% of women and 16% of men identified with the term in America. The number of people who identify as feminists in the West is approaching the number of people who believe that blacks are innately inferior to whites, which is fewer than 10%. Researchers at the University of Toronto discovered that people who were already inclined to favor feminist causes were less likely to do so if they came into contact with a, quote, stereotypical feminist activist. In other words, the more people see feminists, the less likely they are to identify with feminism, even if they're already feminists. The researchers concluded that feminists and other activists ought to behave in a slightly less abrasive manner if they want to win more support for their causes. Good luck with that one, guys. Fortunately for meme creators, feminists continue to do the exact opposite. When you tell a feminist you don't believe in feminism, she'll often respond with the line, "Oh, so you don't believe in equality for women then?" But in both the polls I just mentioned, overwhelming majorities did support equality of the sexes. 86% of men and 74% of women in the UK. 85% overall in the US. I'd love to meet the 26% of British women who don't believe in equality of the sexes, who don't believe that their own gender is equal to the male sex, but I guess we'll save that for another book. Can you think of any other topic that you can get 85% of Americans to agree on? This, after all, is a country where 5% of people believe that Paul McCartney died in 1966 and was replaced by a double. 14%, by the way, aren't sure. Clearly, both genders overwhelmingly believe that feminism and equality no longer mean the same thing. In 2013, feminist filmmaker Cassie Jay began making a documentary about the men's rights movement, feminism's favourite bogeyman. Now, Jay went into the project with the assumption that she was going to be examining a hate group, because that's what feminist bloggers and activists were then branding the men's rights movement. But the facts didn't match the narrative. You see, a Breitbart analysis of stories on NPR's website showed that there are 2.8 times as many stories on women's cancer as men's. And bringing that up in public is a guaranteed route to sneers and ridicule from journalists, regardless of the actual mortality rates. Thus, the phrase men's rights to describe people who draw attention to these disparities and injustices has come to mean misogyny in the mainstream press. On top of the lack of publicity, there's a huge gap in research funding. Prostate cancer sufferers are approximately 10% more likely to survive the disease than those with breast cancer. But figures from the National Cancer Institute show annual funding for breast cancer outstripping that of prostate cancer by double or more. And it's not just cancer. In the top 10 causes of death, heart disease, cancer, stroke, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, accidents, pneumonia, and flu, diabetes, suicide, kidney disease, chronic liver disease, and cirrhosis, men are more likely to die than women in all of them. According to 2014 figures, American women have an average life expectancy of 81.2 years. For men, it's just 76.4. So you see, the gender health gap is very real, unlike the gender wage gap, which is explained completely by life choices. The gender wage gap gives feminists something to complain about and a way to pick up cushy diversity consulting gigs to fix, while the gender health gap leaves men in coffins. Suicide is frequently described as a silent epidemic, thanks to the rapid increase in the number of victims over the past decade. It would not be a silent epidemic if the numbers skewed even slightly toward women. CDC research tracking suicides from 1999 to 2014 found that the rate of male suicide increased 62% faster than the rate of female suicide. Men are now more than four times as likely as women to die by their own hand. A typical third-wave feminist response to this epidemic? Hashtag I bathe in male tears. The men's rights movement has other complaints that hold water. There's a lack of resources for male victims of domestic violence. In Britain, for instance, there are just 78 spaces in the entire country that can be used as shelters for male victims of domestic violence, compared to 4,000 or so for women. And this is despite the fact that women and men suffer domestic violence at roughly similar rates. Even left-wing sources acknowledge this hypocrisy. There's disparity in prison sentencing. A study from the University of Michigan found that on average, men receive sentences that are 63% higher than women for the same crimes committed in the United States. One case in Britain neatly summed up the problem. A woman was spared jail despite stealing £38,000 from her company's debit card because the judge, in his own words, quote, hates sending women to prison, end quote. When a feminist tells you some lie about women earning 79 cents to a man's dollar, remind her that in some US states, custody courts award mothers full-time custody 72% of the time. Now, that's actual discrimination. And the National Organization for Women's website boasts of their opposition to joint custody. On what grounds? Increased father involvement, quote, does not necessarily result in positive outcomes for children, end quote. That's what they say. Well, maybe if those Uber dykes could get somebody to put a baby in them, they'd realize what they're saying is nonsense. These issues alone, putting aside all of the other complaints of the men's rights movement, and there are many complaints, and many of them have merit, some of them are unarguable. From military conscription to workplace fatalities to false rape accusations, the men's rights movement has a point. These are more than enough to justify male advocacy, and even if feminists were concerned by the rhetoric of the men's rights movement, which can occasionally wander over into waspish and unpleasant language, they'd have to be monstrously sociopathic to stop a respectable feminist filmmaker like Cassie Jay from carrying out an impartial investigation of the issues. But that's exactly what happened. Earlier in this book, I mentioned how mercilessly the left perceives traitors to its identity-driven crusades, and Jay was no exception. Despite having a track record of acclaimed work with two award-winning documentaries under her belt, Jay found herself cut off from traditional routes of support. When I interviewed her for Breitbart, she told me that initial grants were withdrawn as soon as it became apparent that she wanted to take a balanced look at the men's rights movement. She said, "We weren't finding executive producers who wanted to take a balanced approach. We found people who wanted to make a feminist film." In her search for funding, Jay learned more about the institutional bias against men's issues. She said, quote, "There are no categories for men's films, although there are several for women and minorities. I submitted the film to human rights categories and I was rejected by all of them," end quote. Jay eventually had no choice but to turn to internet crowdfunding, with Breitbart and a gang of other deplorables lending support. And after I wrote a story about Jay's movie, I'm happy to say it was funded within 24 hours. What does it say about society's hostility to men's issues that it took a gay right-wing provocateur to get a documentary about their concerns off the ground? Where was the establishment with its supposed commitment to equality and fairness and human rights? And why can't people talk about this stuff without getting shouted down or ejected from polite society? Feminists and the establishment weren't content to simply not fund Jay's documentary. They wanted to go further. They accused her of having, quote, "a weird affinity for bigots," end quote, and they actively encouraged boycotts of the film. It wasn't enough that they'd do nothing to help her get it off the ground. They wanted to destroy it and her as well. In Australia, the cinema slated to host the premiere of the movie pulled out after a pressure campaign from feminists. You see, Jay had betrayed the sisterhood, and the claws were out. All it took was the hint of an honest, impartial look at men's issues. On the rare occasion society does take notice of men's issues, feminists are usually there to spoil the party. Movember is an annual event in which men grow their moustaches to raise awareness for prostate cancer. A whimsical, grassroots sort of thing, it's one of the few instances in which awareness of a male cancer briefly rises to the fore. Well, feminists, instead of helping, regularly complain about the press attention that Movember receives. The left-wing New Statesman complained that Movember is, quote, "divisive, gender normative, racist, and ineffective," end quote. Why racist? Apparently because large numbers of minority ethnic men use mustaches as cultural or religious signifiers. Maybe because some races can't grow facial hair. Who knows? Anyway, in an article in Rabble, a Canadian news site, somebody complained about sexist mobros and their exclusionary behavior. Remember, this is a cancer. This is a charitable cancer day. Slate published an editorial from two feminists whining that Movember celebrated masculinity in order to fight cancer. They meant it as a criticism. They wrote, quote, "Are we grumpy contrarians and feminist killjoys who hate things precisely because other people love them? Probably, but..." End quote. Well, at least they have some self-awareness, which is rare for feminists these days. But that doesn't make their article any more palatable. Testicular cancer is also one of the few men's diseases with a grassroots awareness campaign. It's called Cock in a Sock. It's fairly self-explanatory, especially if you're familiar with the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and receives wide praise in the Huffington Post and BuzzFeed. Articles show chiseled men exposing most of their body to raise awareness. But Vice published an article condemning Cock in a Sock as an inane counterpart to the breast cancer awareness no makeup selfie, and claimed, quote, "Without exception, everyone who's doing it is a douchebag," end quote. Fashionista celebrated the objectification of the male form, but complained that a common sight of pubic hair exposed a sexist double standard because men don't have to shave and women do. Once again, feminists were taking a male advocacy campaign and trying to make it all about them. The University of York's Equality and Diversity Committee announced that they would mark International Men's Day with an event addressing men's issues, particularly suicide. But a campaign from more than 200 activist students and professors demanded that the event was cancelled. "We believe," they said, "that men's issues cannot be approached in the same way as unfairness and discrimination towards women, because women are structurally unequal to men," end quote, said an open letter. The University of York quickly complied and cancelled the celebration. But that's not where the story ends, because this happened less than 24 hours after a male student at York had killed himself. As the examples above demonstrate, we're living in an era when much of the feminism on display to the public is petty, mean-spirited, obsessed with trivialities, man-hating, and implacably opposed to free expression. When men try to talk about their problems, and this is something many men are pretty uncomfortable with doing in the first place, they're treated with indifference, anger, or scorn. Because hatred has engulfed the politics of the left. Socialists hate the financially successful. LGBT activists hate Christians. Black Lives Matter hates police officers. Fat people hate skinny people like me and Ann Coulter. But none of these groups hate with the PMS-fueled pettiness of feminism. Here are a few more examples. In 2015, British student activist Bahar Mustafa was pictured beneath a sign on a door that read, "No white cis men, please," while she made a faux tearful gesture beneath it. She had already attracted controversy for banning cisgendered white males from the screening of a film at her university's student union, of which she was then a representative. This incident occurred just as the mainstream press became aware of the return of segregation on campuses under the guise of safe spaces for women and minorities. As the press dug through Mustafa's tweet history, they found tweets in which she used "kill all white men" and "white trash" hashtags. Moderate liberals and establishment conservatives huffed and puffed, and she was eventually put on trial for hate speech, a ridiculous charge for which she was eventually cleared. As odious as Mustafa's opinions were, it's better that they were out in the open, rather than have her gone girl some poor unsuspecting chap. Mustafa wasn't the first of her kind. She was just the first the media took notice of. The new feminist or fourth wave feminist left has been running rampant for years, often with the tolerance and even tacit approval of the establishment and of the left-wing press. Mustafa was set upon because she was an easy target, but less easy a target was Jessica Valenti, a Guardian journalist who proudly posed for pictures wearing a sweater bearing the slogan, "I bathe in male tears." This happened a full year before the Bahar Mustafa incident. Valenti, because she works at The Guardian as a columnist, is considered a protected class by other journalists. Let's be clear, no one should ever be investigated for hate speech as Mustafa was. But it's clear from the example of Valenti, who once wrote the headline, "Feminists don't hate men, but it wouldn't matter if we did," that feminists today are in no way concerned about the equality of the sexes. Many will say I've written far worse than Valenti, and they're right, I have, but I'm not trying to lead a self-proclaimed equality movement. The only cause I represent is that of free speech, where I consider myself part of a long line of boundary pushers who shock the mainstream, whether it's Andres Serrano of Piss Christ fame, all the way up to George Carlin. If I were the leader of an egalitarian movement, it would deserve to be unpopular. The problem with feminists isn't that they're hateful and outrageous, it's that they're hateful and outrageous while claiming to be just, moral, caring, and egalitarian, and they want everyone else to shut up. Plus, of course, almost everything that comes out of their mouths is a blatant lie, which will be covered up by more lies and screeching insults if you dare to call them out on it. On November 14th, 2014, Rolling Stone published the now infamous article, "A Rape on Campus, A Brutal Assault and Struggle for Justice at UVA. It told the story of Jackie, a female student at the University of Virginia, who claimed to have been repeatedly raped by members of the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity. She said, quote, "I heard voices, and I started to scream, and someone pummeled into me and told me to shut up, and that's when I tripped and fell against the coffee table, and it smashed underneath me, and this other boy who was throwing his weight on top of me, and then one of them grabbed my shoulders, one of them put his hand over my mouth, and I bit him, and he straight up punched me in the face. One of them said, 'Grab its motherfucking leg.' As soon as they said it, I knew they were going to rape me," end quote. Sounds almost too gruesome and sadistic to be true. Well, that's because it wasn't true. Within days of publication, the story began to unravel. Journalist Richard Bradley first began to raise questions about it on his personal blog, followed by conservative pundit Steve Saylor. Bradley pointed out that Sabrina Rubin Erdley, the Rolling Stone journalist who wrote the story, failed to identify or even reach out to any of the men who, according to Jackie, repeatedly raped her. Nor did she appear to have identified or communicated with two friends of Jackie's who allegedly corroborated her story. The Washington Post eventually did track down the two corroborators, only to receive a completely different account from them. They told the Post that